This is tape four, side one of the September 15th, 2005 oral history interview with Emeritus Professor Robert Bless.
Well, it turned out that this very staid and by-the-book guy had taken in several Jews during the war and helped them across the border into Spain. Huh. In fact, one of my cousins, the one I'm closest to, as a matter of fact, had taken some of them. He knew the area, having grown up there, he knew it very well, and taken through passes and so on, people, so they get over into Spain. In fact, he was at Yale, or is still at Yale, he was about to retire, and a visiting scholar came, old man, some years ago, and introduced himself. And he was one of the people that his uncle had helped and that Pierre had taken across the border.
How extraordinary.
Wasn't that something? And
indeed.
So that was the end of my heavy commitment with Gemini, and that it did take an enormous amount of time because.
And when did you finally step down as chair?
93.
93.
See, the HSP, the first servicing mission, was in December of 93, and the HSP was being taken out then. The PDR was in December of 93, and that was the end. And it was taking a great deal of time, but it was, in contrast to many of the NASA committees I've been on, this group of people were absolutely first-rate, the board members. And they had to protect their parochial interests, Brits and the Canadians, and then we had some South Americans also. But in general, they could see the forest and not be submerged in the trees. And so it was really a pleasure working with them. It's not it's one of the best groups of that sort that I've ever been with.
Bob, let me ask you, just back on the HSP and the your final disengagement from Hubble. As you think back on it and the problems that Hubble had, do you attribute the fact that the HSP was not able to be utilized to the poor management of the project ultimately? As I recall, you were talking about the firm that built the mirrors was not the one that they should have used.
Well, and it did not receive proper oversight either. And in fact, Kodak made a backup mirror just in case Perkin-Elmer failed, and their backup mirror is perfect.
Really?
Yeah. So, ultimately, as I indicated earlier, Hubble was one until after 83, when Jim Odom became project manager, when they really realized they got to get serious about this thing and treat it properly. It was one of the worst managed projects you could imagine. It was dreadful. So, and ultimately, one of the consequences of that was the mirror. It was a dumb mistake, a mistake that's easy to make. Actually, the spacer had not been put into some optical thing, so the spacing was wrong. But it should have been caught. It should have been checked. There should have been somebody there from NASA who was an expert in that, looking at that, you know, seeing how it was done. This was critical, absolutely critical, Bart. So yeah, ultimately it was
superb science ended up being sabotaged by poor management.
The Hubble has gone on to do very good science.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure I'd characterize what HSP was going to do as superb, because it was a lot of we were trying new things.
Yes.
So it was a lot of groundbreaking stuff, but which we never got to try. Now, maybe it wouldn't have worked, maybe it wouldn't, you know, maybe, but it would have been interesting. In fact, there are satellites up now doing or trying to do what we were trying to do. Interesting stuff, certainly, which we did not have a chance to try.
Bob, one more question about your dual responsibility as a teaching professor at the UW and as one of the nation's leading consultants for NSF and NASA. Yeah. Was the university giving you course release time? You were still expected to carry your load?
Yeah, no, none of us got any release time. The only release time was when Ken Nordzig in our department became an astronaut as part of the WHOOPE program. Then it was clear he couldn't, he couldn't do a course. But no, the rest of us just tried to do as best we could. After 93, I served on a few panels that looked at how Gemini was doing. They wanted people who knew, had some of the history of it and so on, things like that. And, I served also on a few Hubble panels, but that ended fairly quickly.
You'd spent enough time on planes and airports.
Right. Anyway, so the Hubble left a bad taste in my mouth. Gemini left a good taste in my mouth. So
so perhaps it evens out in a way.
Right.
Bob, can we switch now to your time as chair of the department? You've served as associate chair, you said, for several years. And then I think you took over as chair when Art Code stepped down?
No, Don Osterbrock. Code had stepped down before, and Don Osterbrock, who was the most senior person in the department after Code, took over as chair, and he asked me to stay on as associate chair, and I'd been doing it for, I don't know, by that time, 7 or 8 years, so yeah, okay, what the heck, it was no big deal. And in that capacity, I was sort of the executive officer, and life was much simpler then for in departmental administration than it is now. Nowhere near the junk that you have to do and all the restrictions and forms and regulations and all that stuff. It was beginning then. In fact, the first day I became chair after Don, 3 years were up, some big survey of something from the feds came. And that actually was sort of the first big piece of review stuff or whatever, I forgot exactly what it was, that we had to do. And it's gotten worse since.
And so your first year of chair was when?
1970, what is it? Whatever it says there. Chair, department, 72 to 76.
70, okay.
Yeah. Don is a very, very smart guy, very good astronomer, but he didn't like doing the dirty work that one has to do sometimes as chair. So that was left to me, which annoyed me somewhat, but we had a typist who was absolutely, utterly, totally incompetent. And this was back in the days when you were still dealing with Ditto Masters. You remember those?
Oh, sure.
Purple?
Yes.
Well, her keyboard was just colored purple.
Oh, dear.
And that was the time also when typists typed your papers.
Uh-huh.
They weren't computers then. They weren't.
Yes.
So. And they would come back and reshape them.
You gave the drafts.
And he didn't have, she had a very hard family life, and he didn't have the nerve to tell her that after the end of the probation period, it wasn't going to work out. so it was my job to fire her after.
And she had passed probation?
He had approved her probation. And I told him he should not. I feel sorry for her, but we're not a relief organization. You know, we gotta get work out of people. The state, the university's paying money for her to do certain things, and she's not capable of doing them. So that was one of the first jobs I had, which I did as gently as I could over a long period of time. Essentially telling her that I thought she would be better suited to a somewhat different kind of job. I found her a different kind of job on campus.
Oh, you did?
And urged her, which was delicate because she had passed probation, you can't say that you're going to fire you, you know, you get in big trouble civil service.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, it finally got taken care of. That was annoying.
Yes.
A big problem was the one I alluded to the other day, Ted Houck, who had two strikes against him. One was he was alcoholic, the other he was gay. Whether the alcoholism came from the problems associated with his homosexuality, I have no idea. I can't judge that. But the alcoholism did interfere with his teaching. And it also could be that the failure of the first OAO had to do with his alcoholism. We were all terribly depressed at the first failure of the first launch. The launch was successful, the failure after 3 days. It had been a very trying time. There were five or six launch attempts.
Uh-huh.
And on two of them, ignition had started. The first stage ignition had started. And then there's a time of a few seconds when an automatic check is made of various critical subsystems. And if any of those is not proper, it shuts down automatically. If it's proper, the clamps are lifted off and the thrust is built up and the thing goes up.
I see.
Well, two times it shut down before the clamps were released. So we had all kinds of problems. We were all tired, dead tired. And when the thing failed, we sat around in the apartment we had rented near Goddard, because we thought we were going to be there for a while, with a jug of wine on the floor, and all of us sitting with our heads in our hands and not saying a word all afternoon. And it was only much later that we realized that the OAO had ascended on Good Friday and died on Easter Sunday.
Yeah.
So whatever perverse significance you want to put in that. But anyway, I thought that was, but we didn't realize it at the time. And that we were all badly affected by that, and Ted probably more than most because he put so much time into it. That could have contributed to his alcoholism also. but the fact of the matter was he wasn't meeting classes. And this was a big problem, of course.
And he were friends.
We were very good friends. He was my best friend in Madison up to that point until I met my wife.
Uh-huh.
And I was his best friend. And so I went to L&S and talked to the associate dean, Dean DeRemus, who had been associate dean for a long time, knew all the history, knew everything about the college. And a very nice guy, a very sensible guy. And he's told me, oh well, it happens everywhere. It's hardly a department that doesn't have such a case. And you just have to do the best you can, put him in places where he can do little damage. And, you know, not a satisfactory answer, but a humane answer anyhow. And try to get some work out of him, of course. But it was hard to talk to him about it, alcoholism, because he wouldn't admit that he was an alcoholic, and he certainly, I never brought up the fact that I knew he was gay, because I was afraid he might kill himself. In the early 70s, you know, this was a very, very bad. He didn't come out of the closet without suffering severe repercussions. But as I say, and it turned out later that after he died of the liver disease brought on by the alcoholism, I talked to his brother, he asked me why did I know why Ted drank so much, and I hemmed and hawed and hemmed and hawed. And the brother broke in and said, because he was gay. So the family knew about it and accepted it, had no problem with it, but unfortunately Ted didn't realize that and never could talk with anybody about it, as far as I know. So it was a real, real tragedy. He was an extremely talented astronomer and technical instrumentation guy, and a delight to be with. He had a weird sense of humor, we made up during the early days of the space program all kinds of hype from companies about join our company in the new frontier of space and so on and so on. So we made up a company called Horizons Limited. And this was, are you tired of being challenged all the time? And one of our products was a countdown chart, 10, 9, 8, and there was and two of the numbers were misplaced. One of our products, 10, 9, 8, 6, 7, 5. Anyway, a lot of foolishness like that.
Did you have to actually demote him?
No. We just got him to do some things that didn't matter when they got done and things like that. And but he died soon after, and he was drinking himself to death.
That is a tragedy.
But that was the way it was. So that was a big thing during that time. Another thing that we were trying to do was we had the 36-inch Pine Bluff, which is a very nice telescope and very useful for training students, but a small telescope in a site that was originally pretty good, but was becoming surrounded by development.
Uh-huh.
And so the skies were getting brighter. So we were looking around for partners to go in with a larger telescope. And California was interested because the 120-inch was getting also, it was an old telescope, and the sky on Manhattan was getting brighter and so on. So we spent a lot of time on thinking about telescopes and trying to find partners and so on. Maybe it'd be a Big Ten telescope, maybe it'd be trying to get, a lot of effort, nothing came of it, and ultimately it was Wynn that came along, Wisconsin, Indiana, Yale, Ohio. So that was a fair amount of time. My biggest personal project, though, at that time was to get women graduate students.
Hmm.
Osterbrock was dead set against women in astronomy. What'll happen? They'll just go off and get married and have babies and won't do any more astronomy. And he was didn't want to spend his time training somebody who wasn't going to be as much of a replica of Don as he could manage. Hmm. Well, that's one way to look at it, but my feeling was it's none of our business what people do after they get their degree. We hope, of course, they do go into astronomy, but a lot of them have ended up on Wall Street and done very well because of the statistical training they get in astronomy.
Interesting.
So on. So, and I thought it was crazy. And we were one of the few departments who had essentially no female students. Most of the other, the rest of the department didn't much care. They were sure, that's fine, but they weren't going to go out and beat the bushes and try to get some. But I thought we really had to get off our rears and try to get some students. Yeah. So I sort of admitted some students. Went around the admission committee and admitted some female students.
And you had that leeway as chair?
Yeah, because we had very few committees in the department. Most administration was done by the chair.
I see.
It was simple then. And particularly, I'd had a lot of experience, so it wasn't much, wasn't very hard. And so I forgot, maybe I was on the admissions committee at the time, or maybe I was the admissions committee at the time, I don't know. But I just said, okay, we're going to have... And so we admitted two or three women, and finally got some women going. And some of them turned out to be quite good, and so on. But there was, this anti-female attitude was very strong on his part. In fact, we didn't get a, I was again unhappy that we didn't have a female faculty member until Linda Spark. We got Linda Spark, and I was, so we had lots of good applicants. The number, the quality of the young people available now is just incredible. And a lot of them are women. And I said, we have absolutely no excuse not to choose a woman. Because there are plenty of good ones, just as good as the men. And I, and some others too, we pounded the table and said, we've got to hire a woman. So we did, and Linda Spark was the first. Now we have Amy Barger, and we have, my memory. We have two or three female professors. And, a woman from Colorado who's been here just a couple of years. Anyway, we have three. I'm sorry about the names, but it's a consequence of my...
Bob, can you speculate as to why you decided to be proactive in this area? Why you... Was it a fundamental... I'm just curious what drove you to be proactive in this regard.
It seemed crazy. It is totally illogical. Here were these women who had as good records and so on as the men. And why shouldn't we take women? And they were not... I mean, they were having... Women at that time were having a tough time in... getting jobs in academia in general. I mean, you know, the number of women faculty was tiny. And I just thought that was crazy. And I suppose, I'm sure my wife had some had something to do with this, because she ultimately became a faculty member here too. And she had strong feelings about that. But this... Yeah, I was just recently married. I was trying to figure out how I got married.
Well, it's just interesting.
Yeah.
Some scholars did advocate, and others did not. And so I was just curious why you chose to.
I just thought that they were being gypped. Why shouldn't they? I mean, it was ridiculous.
Fundamental issue of fairness.
Yeah, right. Nothing, no deeper motives than that. Also, during that period... I've alluded to the tower, the 70-foot high Forest Service tower that was erected at Pine Bluff, on which we had our standard lamp in which we tried to do this project for which I was initially hired. And when the project finished, we sort of, we put signs up, you know, don't stay off, but that has no effect whatsoever, and put boards up the ladder so that you couldn't climb from the ground. You had to really have to make an effort to climb it, so on. But still, kids from the area were climbing up there. And one night, I think they were both 17, boy and a girl went up there. She was wearing clogs she had borrowed from her sister, which didn't fit. He was carrying a six-pack of beer, and it started to rain, and they decided to come down. Well, with the ill-fitting shoes and the slippery, I mentioned hand over hand, just the ladder, she slipped, fell, and was paralyzed, badly hurt. And, I mean, it was a tragic thing. On the other hand, the reason I mentioned the ages, if they'd been 18, there would have been, I think, no legal case they could have made. What they made, the case was, they sued the university, and the case was made that this was an attractive nuisance. You know, kids used to climb up the outside of the observatory to get on the deck.
Uh-huh.
So we had to try to do things for that, because that was an attractive nuisance. If they've been 18, I think they're supposed to be smart enough to know that it's attractive, but it's not that attractive. You should use your head. Well, they were just underneath, or she was just underneath the age. And, but it still, it was major league stupidity to climb up that tower. And they did not sue the university until a day or two before the time had elapsed.
Oh, I see.
So probably some lawyer got to it. Anyway, so I had the pleasure of being the, what do you call it? The defendant?
You were the defendant.
Because I had been the chair of the department at the time, along with the regents of the university. I was in august company. So this was a certain amount of stress, and one time I visited the lawyer's office several times because they were expecting a trial. And the lawyer said, oh, great news, great news. Yeah, they dropped things. Oh, no, they haven't dropped that. They dropped the regents. You're the only defendant now. I said, oh, thanks a lot. He said, no, you don't understand. A jury is much more likely to find for the plaintiff if the defendant is some nebulous group, some corporation, some headless, you know, people-free outfit. Whereas they see you and you alone as a human and, you know, more or less like them, then there's much less chance of being found guilty.
Small comfort,
I thought. Anyway, I had to give a deposition, among other things, before this went to trial, which was interesting because, you know, this was real stuff and would be used, and I had to be as careful and as possible. And so it was a few hours, and I was nothing as relaxed as this. This was, I was weighing every word and so on. And a funny thing, a week or two later, I got a call from the secretary who had been doing the, you know, the tippy-tapping recording thing. They weren't using a tape recorder. And she was very apologetic, and I seem to have lost part of the transcript.
Oh, no.
Do you remember the answer to this question? Which I did, but I thought, oh, boy, is this the way this is going to go? And, anyway, it turned out that the university, of course, did not want a trial, and the lawyer for the university, and by the way, he specialized in tower incidents. Talk about specialization. But apparently
the university's lawyer?
Yeah, the lawyer they hired to represent the university. He said he thought they had a very weak case. They settled out of court. I never knew what the settlement was, but they said it was on terms very favorable, much better than they could have gotten. Of course, they didn't have the mess of the publicity of a trial and so on. Because the word had gotten out, and people who knew of me, you know, were saying, oh my God, this guy was terrible, he was irresponsible, blah, 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 blah. I mean, so a lot of bad publicity, you know, just from the word of mouth on this. So anyway, that worked out okay, except for the fact that the poor girl, her life was totally changed. So we took the tower down after that.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, we took pictures from every which way and got legal okay to take the tower down. We should have done it before, but I guess. But,
well, you had quite a rich period as a chair. For lack of a better word.
It began in 1970, wasn't that the year of the bombing?
Sterling Hall bombing was 1970. Yeah.
And so that was soon before, I was associate chair then. And that was a very grim time. there was the International Astronomical Union, that's an international group, organization of astronomers. They meet every 3 years, and the meeting was in England, and most of the department was there at the meeting when the bombing took place. Only one guy was here.
Were you here or in England?
I was in England. The guy who was here tried for days to get in. People didn't even, the administration did not remember that the astronomy department was in Stirling Hall. They knew the physics department was there, they knew the Army Math Center was there, but they did not remember that the astronomy, that was the extent to which we were on their radar.
Wow.
Now, the, part of the reason for that is because we never gave them problems. We had all this NASA money coming in, so we didn't have financial problems to deal with, and generally speaking, we were, you know, we got along very well as a department, so we didn't have any scandals, we didn't have any people going to the dean to bitch about this, that, or the other, so they just forgot about us. But they forgot completely. So it was quite a while until he got in. I always resented the fact that the press believed Armstrong and company when they said they didn't want to kill anybody. They waited until late at night to do it. But they called the police a few minutes before they knew the bomb was going to go off. And the police car was actually turning the corner off of Charter, coming up the alley between the chemistry building and Stirling at the time the explosion went off. The car was blown in the air. Had those guys been a few minutes earlier, they'd have been excuse me, in the building and probably killed.
Side two, tape four of the Bless interview.
A graduate student of mine had actually just finished his thesis that night and left early. He left around 2 o'clock in the morning. He was a night person who would work all night. And he would have been there above the thing. His thesis was destroyed, all his...
Oh my gosh.
He had he was a pipe smoker, and he had a bottle of lighter fluid for a pipe lighter.
Uh-huh.
And that caught on fire, and his office burned. Most of the building didn't burn, it was just blown. He didn't realize that his thesis was based on spectroscopic data, which were on, at that time, photographic plates.
Uh-huh.
And he had done an analysis of those plates, and that was the basis for the thesis. The plates had been destroyed, his thesis and all his records had been destroyed. He didn't realize that he had given me a copy of his analysis of the plates. And my office was a mess, but it was inside, it didn't burn, and I could find it and give it to him. So in what was a really remarkable performance, he disappeared for 3 weeks and came back with a second thesis.
How extraordinary.
Yeah, because it was a very, very grim time.
Were you expecting, or other faculty who worked in Stirling Hall, were you aware that Stirling Hall was a focus of the anti-war protest?
Oh, yes. The Army Math Center was very much in the news and very much, and also it was frustrating because I was against the Vietnam War. I thought it was a terrible thing. I still think it was a terrible thing. But I didn't like the way some people were expressing their displeasure with the war.
Uh-huh.
A lot of, you know, the demonstrators ran the whole gamut, from people who were really sincerely against the war and to people who took advantage of the lack of law and order to just be thugs.
Uh-huh.
To people who thought there was no price too large to pay to end the war, blah, 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 you know, whole spectrum. There was one meeting in which a piece of paper was handed out which showed all of the government-supported research labs on campus, of which, of course, a lot of them. And they were all targets because we were all, these were the extremists talking, we were all as culpable as the government itself. We were accepting government money, although, of course, in most cases, it had absolutely nothing to do with military or anything of that sort. But one of the graduate students had been to the meeting, called me up and said, Space Lab, which at that time was at 35 North Park Street, was on this list. So I called up This was in early evening. I called up John McNall, and he and I went down there and looked around in the building, nothing. Then we looked outside the back, and there was a guy climbing up on the roof, and he was going to set fire to the place. And wow. John let out the loudest sound I've ever heard come from a human. I jumped 3 feet. And this scared the guy, and off he took. So he had, I think it was John, who had the idea, we need police protection. So we made it known that there were, in the front office of the space lab, and there were a couple of parking places right in front, and we told employees, no, you don't park there, leave it open, that police could come anytime they wanted to, come in that first office, there'd be a pot of coffee and donuts. They could come take a break. This was when the riots were really bad, really uh-huh. going on. And then, you know, the National Guard was on campus,
yes.
helicopters flying around at night. Boy, that was a terrible sound, with searchlights, you know, looking down. Tear gas in campus, classes a mess. Uh-huh. It was awful. So we let the police know about this, and they loved the place to come because it was close to campus. It was just on the other side of the railroad. And so they were there quite often, and people would see this police car in front of the space lab, and they weren't bothered at all.
That borders on clever, perhaps even manipulative.
Yes, perhaps. But it was very effective. But
yes.
There was, this guy was certainly going to try to burn the place down. So anyway, after the bombing, Findorff was told to rebuild the building. And
that's a local construction
that's
firm?
That's a local construction company. They've been in business in Madison for many, many years. Very good reputation, as far as I know. In fact, they built our house. Our house is built in 1937. It was one of the last residences that Findorff built. They now do big buildings.
Yes.
So anyway, so they were told to rebuild it, and you know, we'll pay. We'll settle up at the end. So it was done completely on the fly. The construction manager was a very reasonable guy. He and I got along very well, and we would get together once or twice a week, and he would I would say, okay, the library used to be here, all the backs of the books had glass and shards embedded in them because of the windows blowing out and so on. If anybody had been there, he'd been killed by all the glass. Library used to be here, let's move this, finish knocking down this wall, and let's move it here, put the outlets here, here, and here, do this, do that. And so that's the way the Sterling, our part of Sterling, got reconstructed. And they were very considerate. They would wait until class changes. We were still trying to hold classes and so on. And they would wait until between classes, the 15 minutes between classes, to do anything that made a lot of noise. And the rest of the time, they tried to keep it as quiet as possible. Of course, things were shuttered off for dust and so on. So they, as I think I maybe off tape mentioned, that it was not until many years later that the drawings representing Sterling Hall the way it really was appeared, because there were no drawings in the reconstruction. It was just...
And so you were the key designer as department chair.
I wasn't department chair at the time. I was 70, but I was associate chair, and Osterbrock didn't want anything to do with it, and so I was doing it. And actually, it was a little bit fun because I had some ideas of what I wanted to do, and I didn't talk to anybody about it.
How long did it take to get Sterling Hall functional?
Well, we were still there. But we couldn't get into the library, we couldn't use the classrooms. Our offices were still, many of them still there. But it was, I'd say 6 months, something like that. Really depressing circumstances, because it was cold, they couldn't keep the drafts out, you know.
Uh-huh.
Dirty, all the dust, all the debris, and we were reminded every day of this thing, a guy had been killed, and some of our students could have been killed, et cetera, et cetera. The Elgin, now the Chazen Art Center, had just opened.
Oh, that's right. Right that same weekend, wasn't it?
I don't know, but it was September was the first month of the, yes. The first full month of their operation, I think. And I used to go down there when I get depressed and sit in the Elgin and think about some of the better aspects of people rather than the worst aspects of people. But yeah, it was a very grim and depressing time for us. But that, as I say, the administration finally realized we existed and were in that building.
a side question, I don't know if you saw the recent alumni magazine that had the feature on Leo Burt, one of the Sterling Hall bombers. And is the only one who's never been found. And there has been quite a bit of reaction that I've read about the inappropriate nature of On Wisconsin running a profile of him. And I'm wondering if you have an opinion about that.
I haven't seen the profile, so it's a little bit hard to say. But I certainly, as I said, I was from the very beginning against the Vietnam War. So it was a terrible mistake and did all the standard things that one does in such instances. But I had no use for people blowing things up and mm-hmm. destroying, turning cars over just for the hell of it because they could get away with it. And mm-hmm. a lot of the students were doing that, and that was really annoying. So I had no sympathy with that, and I certainly had no sympathy with people trying to blow up buildings. And, you know, they tried to bomb the Badger, what's it called, Badger?
Oh, the Army Ammunition Plant?
Ammunition Plant.
Up in Bearable?
Yeah.
No, I didn't remember that.
They got a small airplane and put some kind of explosive in a bottle or something and dropped them. Nothing ever happened. They were pretty incompetent. So I had absolutely no use for them. And in particular, I thought it was just utter nonsense that they didn't want to kill somebody. I mean, after all, the police were pigs, if you recall.
I remember.
And they were fair game. And they certainly gave every evidence of trying to kill them.
It must have been, in a way, if not frightening, disturbing. Here you are, a professor of astronomy. You probably had never envisioned that you would be teaching in this kind of an environment.
No, it wasn't the usual thing. And in fact, I was teaching Astronomy 100 during this period. Some guys came in. Oh yeah, they were trying to shut down the university. And this was a large class, some guys came in and said, you guys shouldn't be here in class and so on. You, professor, you shouldn't be teaching and blah, 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 blah. And I said, look, I'm hired to teach. If people don't want to show up, that's their business, and I will understand and in some ways be sympathetic, but I'm hired to teach and I will be here to teach. Now, if the class wants to spend the rest of the class talking about the pros and cons of the war and arguments and whatnot, I'm willing to do that. But I'm going to meet my class and so on. And so, you know, if you don't like it, just go away. They did. And I asked the class, do you want to discuss it? And they were all so tired by then of all the controversy and all the noise. They said, no, let's get back to astronomy.
Uh-huh. And so, Astronomy 100 was one of the intro courses.
The most intro course.
For science and non-science?
Non-science majors.
Uh-huh.
And so these were just more general people. So anyway,
Bob, anything else on your tenure as department chair?
Not that I can recall. Later, you wanted me to talk about
universities
and chancellors.
Yes, I would like to have you make some observations about your university service and the deans and chancellors you worked with.
Anyway, so do you want to go ahead down the service business?
Yes, yeah. Okay. What university committees did you sit on?
Well, a bunch of them, as a matter of fact. There were a lot of minor ones. The E.B. Fred Fellowship Committee I was on for a while. I was on the Academic Staff Review Committee. That was when they were trying to upgrade the status of the academic staff.
Uh-huh.
Remember, and there were some... So I was a faculty representative on that. I was on the review when they started doing the reviews, internal reviews of departments here. I was on the geology and geophysics review, and that was very interesting. It was led by a guy in geography, like Knox. I remember that. Really good guy, really smart, good organizer. That was interesting.
Was this because the department was in trouble, or was this...
No, this was a standard review.
These were the 10-year reviews
that all departments are supposed to have. And they're internal, and the dean wants them to see, get some outside opinion as to what the department's doing. The department, of course, responds, and it's a way of getting a status for the dean, get a status of the department, and what the plans of the department are, what they expect, what they hope to get from the dean, and so on, what the review committee thinks makes sense in these long-term plans and not. So it's a useful thing. It can be done well, or it can be done as superficially. Unfortunately, sometimes it's done superficially and it's no use at all. But this was a very thorough review, and in fact, one of our recommendations I remember very clearly was to either do something with the geology museum or close it. You are just, this guy is working his tail off trying to make something in the museum, and you're not supporting him, and so make up your mind one way or the other, but don't continue this way. And they decided to continue, and that was a good thing that came out of that.
And what year was that review?
That was in 1978.
Uh-huh. How were you picked to sit on that committee?
I have no idea. I suppose the dean's office looked around for some graybeards and for people who'd had some, it helps if you've been around a while, who'd had some experience on other committees. I'd been on the physical sciences divisional committees in 71 to 74. So I had that behind me. I'd been on chair of a department, that's a useful thing, so on. So I suspect it was just that. They must have.
But probably the review committees are selected. They want distinguished or certainly experienced
people. Experienced people who have some idea of how departments can be run and so on, things like that. So that must have been the reason. So that was fun. There were some minor things, but I served two terms on the divisional committee, 71 to 74 and 80 to 83.
Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, people thought I was crazy knowing what goes on from the first stint to sign up for the second, but actually it was one of the better committees I've ever been on, particularly the 71-74 committee. People, by and large, were rational, generally could see beyond parochial interests and look at the good of a department or the LMS or the university as a whole. I think, at least as it was in 1983, which was the last time I served on a divisional committee, I thought at the time, and I don't know anything more now to change my mind, I thought it was one, that UW has one of the best tenure processes I know of.
Really?
In some places, the dean does it sort of, he decides, I'm sure he talks to people, but he decides and so on. Other places, I mean, there are a whole range of ways of doing it, but having it go from the department to this committee that looks at it really very carefully, the way it's done, or at least used to be done, that a subcommittee would be appointed for each tenure case, usually three people. And they would go over the tenure documents in great detail. They would meet with the department chair. They would meet with other people in the department if they thought it was necessary. If there was any controversy, for example, they would, we often called up people from other universities to find, to get their opinions of certain comments that we were not competent to evaluate, things like that, you know. It was done very seriously, very carefully, as it well, damn well should be. I mean, you're talking about a guy's future.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was very impressed by that process, and I thought in general it was done extremely well and with great fairness. And the other thing we had to do was to approve courses. The idea being to keep from having too many duplicate courses in physics teaching astronomy and astronomy teaching physics, you know, that kind of stuff. Or else make sure there weren't any Mickey Mouse courses getting by.
Was that difficult, both of those issues?
Generally not. I got into an argument with a engineering guy, I think it was, because he was pushing for this course, which I thought was just, had no content. And we had quite a discussion. We, both of us got a little bit louder than we should have been on it. But in general, no, the course stuff was pretty straightforward.
Uh-huh.
We did turn some down because, no, this is too much like so-and-so or like this other course. You ought to get together with this guy. Maybe you could have a joint course, you know, or something like that. But in general, those were easy. The tenure cases were by far the most interesting and took sometimes a huge amount of time.
Uh-huh.
You find out all kinds of things about departments that you don't know, and many things you wish you didn't know. Because particularly in big departments where you have different groups, and these groups act like departments, each group, and they can be very parochial. So there's a certain amount of that you discovered. But no, those were two good committees. I actually enjoyed serving on them, although it took a lot of time. The other major committee I was on was the Graduate School Research Committee. That was when Dean Bach was still around.
And how was that?
That was not as satisfying as the divisional committees. On the divisional committee, we had a woman, she was secretary of faculty. She was the wife of a prominent law professor. I'm sure you know the name I can't remember the name. But anyway, she was very good. She knew everything about LMS. Not just LMS, about the university, because the divisional committees go across colleges, of course, because we physical sciences, engineering, LMS.
Oh, so that was, divisional wasn't just for letters and science, for the whole university.
There used to be four divisional committees. One was physical sciences, one was humanities, one was biological sciences. Maybe there's just three. divisional committees. And so we included all of the physical sciences in LMS. We included a lot of the science departments in ag school. We included all of engineering.
Oh, so that's why you were going head to head with the engineer.
Yeah, right. And so And the biological sciences have people in med school, have people in LNS biology and ag biology. Yeah, it's across the campus.
So that would be interesting.
Yeah, and there are different practices in different, not only in different departments, but in different colleges. And so you became aware of those, whether you wanted to or not. So no, that was extremely, and you had then this person who knew everything about the campus to tell you, no, the rule is such and such, and yes, you can do that, or I know you don't want my opinion, but I'll give it to you anyhow. You ought to do this. Uh-huh. And she was absolutely great. So we didn't have anybody quite as effective as she was on the research committee, but the worst part was that it was chaired by Dean Buck, who had been dean of the grad school forever at that point. And, you know, he was a first-rate scientist and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But my interpretation of it, he was simply tired of being dean. I was appalled. One of the things that you do when you are on the research committee, the main thing you do, is you are given one or two departments whose applications to the graduate school you review and recommend accepting or cutting this or say no entirely or whatever. And much of this is aimed at new faculty who may not yet be established and who can use research committee grants as seed money, money they can say to NSF or NASA or whatever, I have this money and I want some more. I mean, the university is providing this, can you provide that, and so on. All sorts of things like that. The money comes from Wharf, you know, by the way.
Yes.
So it's a very useful thing and very important for young faculty, helping them get started. Well, I was given one year, every year I had physics, and one time I had kinesiology or something like that. It's a
motion,
movement in the physical ed.
Some school of dance,
yeah, something like that, yeah. So strange combination so I would go and talk to the people who were applying for grants, or why weren't they applying, or I've forgotten what the circumstances were. The people in physics, the young people, the new people in physics, didn't know beans about the program, didn't know what they were expected to do, encouraged to do. And so I spent a lot of time telling them, look, here's what you can do, here's the form to fill out, here's what, blah, 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 here's what, you can try to get a graduate student, you can try to get some support money, blah, 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 and since you're new and so on, the chances are very good that you'll get the money, and so please, if you want, take advantage of it. They didn't know about any of this. This happened a couple of years. I thought, look, physics is doing an absolutely lousy job of telling their new people about programs like this. I brought this up at a research committee meeting. I said, look, if physics is doing it, it's not likely they're the only department on campus. Shouldn't the committee send out a notice to everybody on the faculty saying, remember these things, remember young people, your new faculty members, they don't know about this, you've got to be told, blah, 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 blah. And the dean just dismissed it. Oh, no, that's not a problem. That's not a problem. Next point. He didn't even discuss it. I brought it up two times. It was just, he dismissed it out of hand. And we were still using Xerox copies of announcements and documents that had been printed on not ditto machines, but the
mimeograph
machines. They're that old.
Wow.
He didn't want to change anything. He didn't want to do anything. It was perfect the way it was. So,
how long were you on that committee?
3 years. I think the term was 3 years. And I was not impressed.
Okay, and that was, what years were those?
86 to 89.
So you were doing that work while you were teaching and also working on Hubble?
Oh, yeah.
You were quite busy.
Yeah.
Were you ever home?
Yeah, I was home, but... yeah, I was on a nominating committee, 91, 93, because I'd been on all these committees before, so, and various other things. But those were the main, one thing that was sort of fun. I was the chair of the committee to name the Physics, Pharmacy, Astronomy building, which is now Chamberlain Hall. And, of course, it was obvious why I was chosen as chair, because you had one big department, physics, one big school, pharmacy, and you had tiny little astronomy. And so I was the... And, of course, first meeting, physics wanted to name it for a physicist, pharmacy wanted to name it for a pharmacist, and I said, I'm not going to say we name it for an astronomer, but we'll never get anywhere. So let's meet after a while, I said. So I went, and for the first time I read the history of the University of Wisconsin, the one that's written by Curdy and...
Hovey?
Curdy, you know.
Merle Curdy?
Merle Curdy and...
History. And
Cronin did an update. But anyway, it was this two-volume thing. Mm-hmm. To see if I could have any ideas. Well, I did have an idea. Namely, Chamberlain had been dean of the graduate school. In fact, he was, and he was the first dean to really emphasize research. And he was a prominent researcher himself. He'd been lured by Rockefeller when the University of Chicago was being formed.
Uh-huh.
He was a geologist. Chamberlain Moulton, theory of the solar system origin. If you're old enough, which you aren't, that was taught in school years and years ago. So I said, look. Here is a guy, he's not associated with pharmacy, he's not associated with physics, he's not associated with astronomy, he's a geologist, but he was really pushing astronomy, research. Why don't we name it Chamberlain Hall? Grumble, 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 all right. So that's how it became Chamberlain Hall.
Really? It was grudging. So, but
yeah, but...
Well, John Mathis said about you that you were very tactful and wise.
Well,
and that strikes me. You needed both of those qualities.
I don't know. It was pretty obvious that we were not going to get anywhere if we went physics or astronomy and physics or pharmacy. So, you know, that was an obvious kind of thing to do. But it was sort of fun because I was gently telling these two big departments what they ought to do, and that was fun. So that was essentially my experience on committees and so on.
Were you involved with faculty senate at all?
Just when it got going, the first year.